Welcome to the deep dive. Today, we're really going top to bottom on the stack.
Huh?
From, the shiny surface of modern dev tools down to the bare metal, well, almost the operating system kernel underneath.
Right.
We are diving deep into dev containers and how they intersect with the architecture of the Ubuntu Linux kernel.
Yeah, and it's fascinating because our source material today really forces us to connect these two worlds, that often treated completely separately.
They really are.
So many developers use dev containers daily, right? For convenience. But very few really stop and ask, okay, how does this containerized environment actually talk to the system?
Yeah, what's the magic?
Exactly. And what's the architecture making that connection work? That's what we want to unpack today, the how at its core.
Okay, let's do it. So if you ask someone, a developer, what a dev container is, the first answer you often get is something like,
It's just Docker with VS Code.
yes, exactly. It's
Yeah.
just a handy way to interact with the Docker container using a VS Code front end. Sounds, well, kind of simple, like just a wrapper.
And that really undersells the engineering involved. It's a starting point, sure, but dev containers are doing so much more than just wrapping Docker.
Okay.
They fundamentally change how you set up environments. They use this pretty sophisticated client-server architecture to give you a full, complete development environment inside the container.
Right.
If it were just a simple wrapper, you'd hit all those usual Docker networking annoyances, and well, you don't.
That's a key difference. So, all right, walk us through the mechanics then. When I'm on my machine, my laptop, whatever, and I hit that button, reopening container, what actually happens? What gets triggered on the server side?
Okay, so it kicks off this really clever client-server split. Your local VS Code, the window you're looking at, that's the client.
Okay, handles the UI, clicks, typing.
Exactly, all the visual stuff.
Yeah.
But pretty much everything else, compiling code, running debuggers, executing extensions, that all happens on the server side.
And the server side is the container itself.
Precisely. The
Yeah.
container becomes the server environment.
Okay, this is where it gets really interesting for me. How does the system actually build that perfect isolated environment inside the container?
It all starts with a blueprint, that .devcontainer.json file in your project.
Right, I've seen this.
So first, VS Code tells Docker, build and start a container using this configuration. That JSON file defines everything, the base Linux image, ports you might need forwarded later, and crucially, any commands to run after the container is created, like installing SDKs, dependencies, tools.
The post create command. So that JSON isn't just config, it's like the entire environment definition, and it's checked into Git with the code.
Exactly right. Your environment definition lives right alongside your code. Version controlled, the whole deal.
Okay.
Now, step two. This is critical, and it's frankly genius. VS Code automatically installs a special headless process inside that container.
Headless.
Yeah, it's called the VS Code server. It's not the full desktop app you see. It's a dedicated backend running quietly inside that isolated container.
Wait, hang on. If this server is running inside an isolated Docker network, maybe on some random internal port, how does my local VS Code client, which could be on Windows or Mac OS, how does it talk to it? Usually with Docker, I'd have to manually map ports, expose them, maybe fiddle with firewalls. That's often the biggest pain point.
Right. And that's the third action, the really elegant engineering solution. They avoid all that complex manual TCP/IP routing.
How?
Instead, the client communicates with the server using the Docker control channel itself.
The control channel, I mean, like the commands Docker uses to manage containers.
Basically, yeah, it uses Docker exec. It's like VS Code is SSHing into the container, but using Docker's own secure pathway.
Wow. Okay, so VS Code is literally executing commands inside the running container shell to shuttle data back and forth.
That's the core idea.
So it completely sidesteps needing public listeners or complex network setups. It's just using the pipe that's already there between the Docker client and daemon, secure by default.
Exactly. It turns what could be a massive networking headache
Oh.
into essentially just running commands. Super efficient.
Okay, efficient, but what about speed? If it has to install this VS Code server every single time I open a project, wouldn't that still be slow?
Good point. Persistence. They thought of that.
Yeah.
To make it fast, Docker automatically creates a persistent named volume, usually just called VSCode.
A Docker volume,
And
yeah.
then this volume stores the VS Code server executable itself and any extensions you've specified for that container. So the first time you connect, yeah, it downloads and sets things up. But the second time, and every time after.
It's already there and the volume mounts instantly.
Exactly. The environment spins up almost immediately because the big pieces are already cached.
That makes sense. Okay, so we've got the mechanism. Let's zoom out a bit. Why is this whole setup, this architecture, so revolutionary for development teams? What's the big aha moment?
Well, there are really three huge ones, I think. First is isolation. Your main machine, your laptop, stays completely clean. You can have one project needing, I don't know, cutting-edge Java, and another needing some ancient Node.js version.
And they won't clash.
Impossible. They're in totally separate Docker containers.
Okay, so that directly tackles the classic works on my machine problem.
Which
And on
one?
these two.
Reproducibility. Everyone on the team gets the exact same environment. Every single time. Doesn't matter if they're on Windows, Mac, Linux.
No more. Well, what version of X do you have?
Arguments.
Gone. Days of wasted time trying to sync up library versions just disappear.
And the third thing.
Think about onboarding a new team member.
Oh, yeah. That can take days sometimes.
Right. Installing the right SDKs, configuring databases, wrestling with package managers. Instead, they clone the repo, open VS Code, click reopen in container, and they're productive, maybe in minutes. The whole toolchain is just there, prepackaged by that devcontainer.json.
That's huge. And one more thing occurs to me, that JSON file being version controlled.
Yes. Version control for your environment.
So if you upgrade, say, Python in the devcontainer.json and it breaks the build.
You just roll back that commit, just like you'd roll back broken code. The environment's no longer some assumed thing. It's a first-class version part of the project.
Wow. Okay, that's a really compelling case for containerized development. But all right, now we need to shift gears. We've been in this nice, clean, virtual world. But where does this container actually run? What's underneath it all? We need to go from virtualization down to the core system, the Ubuntu kernel.
Right, we're moving from the application layer down to the foundation. The kernel is the absolute core. It's the master control program.
Running with the highest privileges.
Highest privileges, yeah.
Yeah.
It manages everything. Memory, CPU scheduling, talking to hardware, network stacks.
Yeah.
It's what makes even running Docker possible in the first place.
So where does this super critical program physically live on, say, an Ubuntu system, if I wanted to point to
It actually lives in a few places, depending on what you mean by live. The actual compiled program, the binary that the system boots and runs, that's in boot. If you look in there, you'll see files like vmlin followed by a version number, like vmlin a 6.14.0-35 generic.
And those letters, vmlinu, they mean something specific.
They do. EVM generally stands for virtual memory, meaning it supports modern memory management. And the Z at the end is key. It means it's a compressed image.
Compressed. Why?
To make it smaller, so it loads faster during the boot sequence, every little bit helps them.
Makes sense. And alongside vimlinus, there's usually an ninard.mmg file too.
Right, the initial RAM disk. Think of it as a tiny temporary root file system loaded into memory very early in the boot
Why
process.
temporary?
Because the main hard drive file system might need special drivers to be mounted, and those drivers might be on that file system. Chicken and egg problem. So the editor contains just enough essential drivers, tools to find and mount the real root file system. Then it hands over control.
Okay, so boot has the runnable kernel, but what if I'm, say, a developer or sysadmin, and I need to compile a custom kernel module, like a new device driver? Where are the instructions, the source code stuff I need?
Right, for compiling modules, you need the kernel headers. Not the whole source, usually just the headers. And those typically live in usrsrc.
usrsrc.
You'll find directories there named like Linux headers matching your kernel version, like osrs Linux headers 6.14-035. You absolutely need those to compile a module correctly so it links properly with the running kernel.
Without the right headers, it just won't compile.
Nope. It needs to know the interfaces of the kernel it's going to plug into.
And the source has mentioned a kind of shortcut the build system uses.
Yeah, there's a convention. Inside libmodules, then a directory named after your kernel version. You get that version string with the command unnamed inside that directory.
So, like libmodules 6.14.035 generic.
Exactly. Inside there, you'll find symbolic links, usually named
Yep.
build and source.
Vim links.
Yeah, pointers. They point back to the actual header directory in usrsrc. Build tools and scripts often rely on these links to find the right headers automatically without hard coding the path. Very handy.
Okay, this structure is interesting, but what's really fundamental, the absolute bedrock of how Linux ensures stability and security, is this boundary, the split between kernel space and user space. Let's really dig into that.
Absolutely. This is the foundational concept enforced right down at the CPU level using protection rings. Think of kernel space, also called ring zero, as like the high security control room for the entire system.
The control room. Got it. Total power.
Total power, unrestricted access, code running in ring zero, which is the kernel itself, and any loaded modules like drivers, can directly touch any piece of hardware, access any memory address, it holds the master keys.
And the flip side of that total power, if something goes wrong in the control room, a bug in kernel code.
Boom. The whole system crashes. Instantly. A kernel panic. That's why kernel development is so rigorous.
Okay, so that's ring zero, the kernel space. What about the rest? Where do my browser, my text editor, the shell inside my dev container, where do they run?
They run in user space, which is ring three on most systems. Think of this as all the regular offices and apartments outside the main control room.
Restricted access?
Very restricted privileges, yes. Applications running here are isolated from each other. One application generally can't just peek into the memory of another, and crucially, they absolutely cannot directly access hardware or mess with the kernel's core functions.
So let's connect this back. My application inside the dev container, which is running in user space, say it needs to write a log file to the disk. That involves hardware, which is controlled by the kernel space control room. How does it ask permission?
It has to use the official guarded entryway, system calls or syscalls.
Syscalls, okay.
These are the kernel's published API. When a user space program needs a privileged operation like opening a file, reading data, creating a network connection socket, starting another process fork, it makes a syscall.
So it's like filling out a request form and handing it to the control room operator.
That's a great analogy, yeah. The application basically says, hey, kernel, please do this for me, and hands over the necessary info. The CPU then performs a context switch, temporarily elevating privilege to ring zero. The kernel executes their request, and then it switches back down to ring three to return the result to the application.
That context switch, going from ring three up to ring zero and back down, that sounds like it would take time. It must have a performance cost.
Oh, absolutely. It's not free. There's overhead involved in switching context, saving state, validating parameters. Minimizing unnecessary syscalls is actually a really big part of optimizing high-performance applications.
But it's the necessary price for safety.
Exactly. It's the fundamental mechanism that prevents a buggy or malicious app in one office, user space, from accidentally or intentionally crashing the entire building, kernel space, or messing with its neighbors. Security and stability depend on this strict separation.
Okay, so the kernel is loaded, running, managing hardware, handling syscalls safely, but the system isn't fully up yet. We need something to actually start all the services, the networking, the Docker daemon itself.
This brings us to layer two, right? The init system, which on modern Ubuntu is systemed.
Right. Once the kernel gets itself initialized and mounts the root file system, its very last job is to start the first user space process. And that process is systemed.
And it gets a special ID.
It gets process ID 1, PID 1.
Why is PID 1 so important? Is it just a number?
It's way more than just a number. PID 1 is special. It can't be easily killed like other processes, and it becomes the ultimate ancestor, the parent or grandparent of basically every other user process on the system.
The great grandparent of all processes.
Pretty much. And if a process becomes orphaned, meaning its direct parent exits, PID 1 adopts it and is responsible for cleaning it up later, reaving it. So systemed as PID 1 isn't just a simple starter. It's really the manager of the entire user space lifecycle.
And it's not just about starting things in order, is it? Systemed is more like a whole suite of tools. It really is. It handles service management, starting, stopping, restarting daemons, system initialization, bringing up network interfaces, mounting file systems, and even things like device management, working closely with your dev to react when you plug in hardware.
And logging too, right?
Yes. Centralized logging via journaled is another major component. It aims to be an integrated backbone for managing the running system.
Okay, and system also sets up those really cool virtual file systems, the ones that let us peek into the kernel.
Yeah. That's another key role. It mounts what are called API file systems. These aren't files on disk. They're dynamic interfaces to kernel data structures. Sys is one, the Sys file system. It exposes a huge amount of information about devices, drivers, buses, all structured hierarchically.
Like a live map of the hardware.
Kinda, yeah. And even more commonly used is proc, the proc file system. This exposes information about running processes and various kernel parameters.
So if I look at, say, proc 1234.
You're seeing live data about the process with ID 1234, its memory usage, open files, command line, environment variables. It's a direct window into the kernel's process table for that process.
Yep.
Incredibly useful for diagnostics.
Okay, let's put it all together then. Can we trace the boot sequence really quickly from power on to having a running Ubuntu host that's ready for my dev container?
Sure. So power on. The machine's firmware, BIOS UEFI, does basic hardware checks, and then finds and loads the bootloader, which is usually GRUB on Ubuntu.
Okay, GRUB.
GOG's job is to find the kernel image, familyness, and initial RAM disk, initfrm.mmg, in boot. It loads them into memory and jumps to the kernel starting point.
Kernel takes over.
It initializes itself, decompresses, uses the initrid to load essential drivers, like for the disk controller, finds and mounts the real root file system, like devs.1 on.
And its final act?
Its final act, once the root file system is ready, is to execute spinit, which on modern systems is usually a link to system.
Starting PID 1.
And from there, system takes charge of user space, it reads its configuration, starts services in parallel based on dependencies, networking, logging, eventually Docker daemon, all the way up to the login prompt or graphical environment.
And then our dev container can finally start relying on that Docker daemon. Wow, it's quite a journey from firmware to container.
It's definitely layered, and understanding those layers helps immensely when things go wrong.
And for listeners who want to explore this on their own running system, right now our sources had a great practical tip.
Yeah, absolutely. Linux is wonderfully transparent. If you want to see exactly how your current running kernel was configured and built, you can often just look at the file proconfig.gz.
Proconfig.gz.
Yeah, zipcat proconfig.gz list. It dumps out the entire build time configuration, or just spend some time navigating sys with CDNLs. You can literally explore the detected hardware and drivers live. It's all there.
Okay, this has been a fantastic deep dive. We've gone from the convenience and abstraction of dev containers
down to the fundamental privilege, rings and syscalls, managed by the kernel.
Yeah. So the two big pillars we covered, dev containers giving us that modern isolation, speed, and reproducibility through that really neat client-server split and the devcontainer.json.
Right. And then the Ubuntu kernel, providing that rock-solid layered foundation, that strict separation of kernel space, ring zero, and user space, ring three, mediated by syscalls and all orchestrated and brought to life by systemd.
And understanding the stack, where the kernel lives, how it talks, how system boots everything, it's just invaluable, isn't it? Whether you're debugging an app in a container or trying to figure out why the host system itself feels sluggish.
Absolutely. That foundational knowledge applies everywhere. And the beauty of Linux is that it invites you to learn. The source code is usually right there in US, the US, their SSE. The live system state is mapped out for you in proc and sys.
And that's really the thought we want to leave you with today. Unlike closed systems where the core is a black box, the heart of so much modern computing Linux is open.
It rewards curiosity.
It really does. The source is an invitation. The system state is transparent. You're invited to investigate, to understand these core mechanisms maybe deeper than you ever thought you could. So go poke around in proc and sys, see what you find.
Definitely. And we'll catch you on the next deep dive.